The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
American prosperity is the bedrock of freedom and security all over the world.
An obligation to the heritage of liberty and dignity handed down to us by our forefathers.
It's time for the Pro-America Report with Ed Martin on The Answer San Diego.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro-America Report. Great to be together as always. I had a day or two where I've been on the move and on the run. Thank you to Ryan Hyde, our great producer and communications director for the Phyllis Schlaff Legals. He fills in a lot for me. Our Mason Mohan, our other associate producer, he's been off. Wife had a baby. His and their family's doing great. So happening, a lot happening. Great to be together. Don't forget, visit ProAmericaReport.com, ProAmericaReport.com. I'm about to hit send on a post there of what I'm going to talk to you about on the details of what is happening with the Hoyagate, we call it. And we'll get to that in a moment. But please listen, wait, make sure you listen to this, the fourth segment of today's program, because I really want to talk to John Schlafly. We've got Benzman, Todd Benzman on with us and all. But the fourth segment is about our friend Jeff Clark. One of the most honorable guys I've met, one of the smartest, darn smartest lawyers I've seen, just extraordinary. And he is going to have to go before the D.C. bar in what I think is not just a kangaroo court. It's an insult to the legal community that this is happening to a guy like him. But he's got to go. There's a bar complaint against him. And he's got to deal with it next week. So I'm going to talk about that at the fourth segment. I hope you'll come along there and pay attention to that. So, but first, let's get to Hoyagate. Hoyagate is the situation here where DeRoy Murdoch exposed how Georgetown University's, especially through the School of Law, has been running this partisan, he called it viciously partisan effort to try to get Trump and stop Trump. And way beyond what's appropriate and what should happen when you're talking about a nonprofit, tax deductible, Catholic, Jesuit Catholic school. And so, you know, DeRoy Murdoch named names. Rosa Brooks is a dean there. Mary McCord is running an institute there, and on through a list of other people. Well, when that news hit on Monday, I can tell you everybody was paying attention. Everybody was saying, what is the deal here? At the highest levels, people were like, what is going on? I don't know for sure, but I have some reports. I can't say it's 100% because I've only got one source. I don't like to, I'm not like the fake news where you get one source that you like and you say, therefore, you know everything. I don't know for sure, but I will tell you that the source that I have tells me that the Georgetown University, they're pretty concerned. They're worried about it. They are not happy with what is going on and not happy with what they're seeing. And so all very interesting. But here's the next step. Here's what happens. This is why it's so important that the Republicans won the House a few years ago. Congressman Pete Sessions, who I know very well, I consider him a friend. Back when I ran for Congress in 2010, he was one of the earliest people who supported me. He's from Texas, from down around Waco. He was born and raised in Waco, and his district is all around Waco. And so he saw this article by DeRoy Murdoch, and he decided, well, I'm a chairman of a subcommittee of oversight, and my oversight pertains to federal employees and what's happening in the federal government. So I'm going to send a letter over to Georgetown and say, hey, guys, give me some information on this. And so his letter went out yesterday, Thursday, and boy, oh, boy, got some attention. Because here's what he basically said. I see specifics of your personnel in print. speaking to the Washington Post, speaking to NBC News, talking about the things they're doing. They sound way beyond what is supposed to happen at a university like this. So if you're doing this or sponsoring it, let's talk about it. Transition Integrity Project is one. That was back in 2020. There's an effort to stop Trump. To stop Trump. If Trump won, they said we have to stop Trump from having control of the military. What? That's what our Constitution demands. And so what Pete Sessions said was, I want to see what you're up to. My oversight says I can ask questions, especially about some of these people that are touching on the issues that we're talking about in their capacity, either as a current employee or a recent employee, using Georgetown University, as that Hoya Gate article from Dory Murdoch showed, they received close to $1 billion. I think it's $750 million in the last 3 or 4 years. So if you're getting all that money, you're tax deductible, you're supposed to be nonpartisan. What are you doing? So this is a thread pulling exercise. And look, it may be there's nothing to see here. It might well be that there is nothing to see, but we ought to get to the bottom of it. And I have good confidence. I have confidence that Pete Sessions has decided he's going to. So that's a big deal. And as one of the journalists who's writing on this now said to me, uh-oh, if you're Georgetown, you're the general counsel at Georgetown, you're the president of Georgetown, board of directors, you're not going to be quite as loose when you're seeing that a congressman and his committee is asking, what are you up to? And so if the people that did something wrong were shredding, the shredder stopped, because that's notice. That's notice that we're looking at it, and you don't want to go cross that. So it's very good news. I was very excited. You know, I had one of my colleagues in the conservative movement said, oh, another letter. We'll see. First of all, a letter will have a big impact. If you frame the letter right, and I saw what he wrote, what Pete Sessions and his staff wrote, if you frame the letter right, you got a way to make a lot of people pay attention. They're going to pay attention in a way that, you know, that they weren't before and that you might not expect. So while a letter is not an investigation, it's not a hearing yet, it's important. It's an important start. It's an important start. And very cool. It's very cool. And I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see where it goes. And we've got hearings on things like impeachment. And obviously this week that Bobulinski character was really good at shining a light on things. But a lot of times, it's just making a little bit of progress to pull apart these, you know, truly these conspiracies to try to change the government, to try to dominate the government. I mean, if what the Transition Integrity Project claimed that they did, if that really happened, a lot of the aspects of what they were talking about ended up happening, both with the Russia hoax, as well as with things like January 6th. And when the overlap of people that is undertaking this grand conspiracy to stop Trump includes the people who were fortifying the election in 2020, it at least makes you say, wait a second, is there more here? Is there more we can get to the bottom of? And as a friend of mine said, hopefully it modifies behavior going forward. Because I always tell people, when I ran the election board in St. Louis, it was 2005 and six. One of the things I learned is that you have to do two things. You have to do two things with any election board. One is run a competent election. But that's actually harder than you think, because it's a complex system that has to be put in place, but only three times a year, maybe four times a year. If you have a municipal election, you might have a municipal election with a primary and a general municipal election. Then you have a major election. Four could be five times a year, but usually it's less than five, where you actually do what you're supposed to do. So you got to prepare for game day, but you only have four games a year. That's hard to do. It's hard to practice an election too. You can't really do it. Now, sometimes you get like special elections and you can practice how some of the things work, but you got to get the people, you got to get the systems, you got to make it run well. It's got to have integrity. It's got to be protected. But the second thing you have to do is you have to speak publicly about the importance of protecting the elections, and that the elections are, you can't steal them. If you try, we're going to stop you. And that people have confidence, because it's a election voting in America. It's not mandatory. And so in order to get participation, You have to make people believe in what you're doing. So you got to believe. You got to be an advocate. You got to do things. Go to the communities and say, hey, hey, it's worth it. It's worth it. Come out and do this. It's not going to get stolen. Your vote's going to count. You know, do this. And that's what you've got to do. Well, when you talk about abuse by Georgetown University of the public square, of public dollars, of their role, of their perhaps their security clearances, whatever it is, by talking about it publicly, hopefully you can stop some of the future conduct. If they were doing things wrong in the past, you also want to stop them from doing it in the future, not just hold them accountable. I hope Pete Sessions gets to the bottom of what they did. But as they get to the bottom of what they did, it looks like game planning for a coup and using the federal dollars and using a nonprofit to do it. Very bad. But in addition to getting to the bottom of it, you got to stop it happening in the future, because there may or may not be a Republican president next. But if there is, they've signaled that they're going to use these apparatus, these people, in ways that are, if not inappropriate, they're suspect. And we ought to get to the bottom of it. All right, that's what you need to know today. Check that out. Go proamericareport.com. Go there. You'll see my recent post on this. And there's another one coming very soon. So check that out. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Don't forget, go to proamericareport.com, sign up there, and visit phyllisschlafly.com for all the great work that's going on. We'll be back. We'll talk with John Schlafly as well as Todd Benzman in a moment right here on the Pro America Report. Be right back. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. We're with John Schlafly, catching up with John Schlafly Weekly. He, of course, writes a weekly column, the Phyllis Schlafly Report, with his brother Andy. It posts over at townhall.com, usually late Tuesday, sometimes Wednesday morning, and is archived at phyllisschlafly.com. Always helpful to check in on what John and Andy are seeing happening and how they see what has occurred. This week's column is about the U.S. Supreme Court. A little critical. So welcome back, John. And tell us what you saw. I guess Monday you were focusing in on one day. But tell us what you saw in the court and what you think it means more broadly.
Well, hello, Ed. Good to be with you. Yeah, there were several, you know, cases we're following that were heard in the Supreme Court on Monday or dealt with. Actually, the most recent one was at the end of the day, where they did allow the Texas law, the new Texas law that permits Texas to arrest illegal aliens and take them to the border for deportation. Supreme Court, at the end of the day, somewhat to everyone's surprise, allowed that to continue, although when it got back to the lower court blocked it again, pending a full hearing, which will take place next week or the week after that. So we're watching that carefully, because we've just seen how the border between Mexico and Texas has been completely overrun. Federal officials and state officials are unable to cope with the onslaught of people coming. And, of course, they're not stopping at the border. They're fanning out, being flown to all over the country, and we've seen these horrible crimes that some of them have committed.
To clarify for one second, I do want you to get to the other end in the column, but to clarify, yeah, what happened, the Supreme Court said, yes, Texas can go ahead and do this. But then the Biden administration, I guess, went right back into court, and the lower court said, on a different sort of grounds, we're going to stop this because we want a full hearing. And so, I mean, isn't that sort of the lower court flouting the authority of the Supreme Court? I mean, the Supreme Court could have said the same thing, could have said, you know, we'll hold it until we decide. I mean, is that a bigger deal than I'm seeing, or is it lesser?
It's a complicated procedure, because actually neither the Supreme Court nor the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals have issued a final ruling on this new Texas law yet. So what's being bounced around is whether there will be a stay pending appeal, whether the Texas law will be blocked while the case goes forward.
I see.
And there are standards in the courts for answering that question, and complicated. That's a complicated issue in itself. Meanwhile, the courts have yet to rule on whether the law, you know, the argument is, the Biden administration is making, is that Texas has no right to interfere if the Biden administration wants to open the border. That's what that's what it comes down to.
Right.
Texas is saying, no, federal law requires unlawful entrance and people here unlawfully to be removed. And so Texas is saying they're supporting federal law.
I see.
And they should be allowed to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
Biden
cannot
take federal law and refuse to enforce it.
Yeah, you have to wonder when you see
that. We are.
If you see the images in the last 48 hours or so of the one border confrontation where literally, they were over the law enforcement. I think it was not. I think it was maybe this Texas State Guard and some ICE agents, but they were overrun by, you know, adult males that just pushed their way through. So, I mean, the images of that, and who knows how widespread that was or what the video really showed, you know, broadly. But it's coming to a head, obviously, and we can see that, although it doesn't seem to be changing the Biden administration's position. Anyway, John, back to the column.
Well,
there
have been the video yesterday. Yes, there have been many other similar videos. Yes, these are mostly single adult males of fighting age. And it's an army coming in. And it's an invasion and needs to be treated that way.
All right. So back to your column, though, this week's column. We're talking with John Schlafly. The Schlafly Report is available over at phyllisschlafly.com, archived there. What else do we have? The Supreme Court. Justice Ketanji Jackson got the most attention for her comments, in the last months, based on the Murphy versus Missouri and what she basically said about the First Amendment. But what else was in the on that Monday?
Well, that case has been pending for a couple years, and it has to do with the issue of the people in the Biden administration pressuring Facebook and Twitter. This was before Elon Musk bought Twitter. Pressuring those social media accounts to throw out voices that deviated from the official line of the Biden administration, especially about the pandemic. And so there was abundant evidence produced in court that officials of the Biden administration had communicated with Facebook, Google, and Twitter, telling them to remove posts by, you know, many, many people. And those services did exactly what the Biden administration told them to do. And the argument of the lawsuit is that's a violation of the First Amendment. The government should not be telling social media to remove citizens' posts, and yet that's what they did. Unfortunately, the case got an unfriendly reception in the Supreme Court, and it wasn't just Ketanji Brown Braxton, and it wasn't just Elena Kagan who said, you know, this goes on thousands of times, you know, every day with different agencies of the administration communicating with social media, and there's nothing wrong with that, she said. But there is something wrong with that, because we're now down to a situation in our country where there's only a handful, 3, 4, 5 major social media entities through which all public expression of opinion is being funneled. And
right.
We can't have, if the government is effectively moderating those sites, that's a violation of the First Amendment, because that prevents you and me from expressing our views on the place where the whole country is. And so this is the case that's now been presented to the Supreme Court, and at great expense and effort by some people we know, and which the case was upheld in the lower courts, but the Supreme Court looks like it has a dim view of this, and it looks like they're not going to call the federal government to account for what they did by silencing voices expressing their legitimate opinions about what to do about the pandemic.
Yeah,
so that was disappointing.
That one to me, John, is a big one, because
I understand some of the conservative judges or the mindset. I understand when they say, well, you know, the government's going to interact with media, social media in this way. As you point out, the difference is the moment in history, the technology, where we are. And I think private communications of, say, the Undersecretary of Commerce in 1975 to say to the New York Times, you know, don't run this story. We don't think that that's really good. Don't hold that for a while or whatever is vastly different than basically the government in 2024 being able to say to Meta or to X or to any of them, you must operate like this. Because they have more influence and power. And as you point out, it's more effective. I hate to say it that way, but I don't know if that is the right way to get to a principled answer, but it seems like we're down a fast slope. My last question, John, we're going to run out of time. I got less than a minute. All of this strikes me when you hear the government doing that and you watch what they're doing to President Trump. I mean, the lawfare is on the march. Nobody is chastened by videos of the border being overrun or stupid quotes from a justice. They continue. They're going to try to seize Trump's assets. It means lawfare is on the march. It's not slowing down.
That's right. And the number of cases that Trump is being forced to, manage is really astounding. And of course, now, you know, Trump has his own social media platform called Social, which has been growing. And it looks like it's about to come on, have a big day on the stock market pretty soon, which is amazing. He set that up as an alternative to Twitter. And it's going great guns. I'd encourage all of your listeners to check it out and to sign up for an account there.
Yeah, no, I agree. Great point, John. All right, John, I got to go. John Schlafly, everybody. Again, the Schlafly Report, John and Andy Schlafly, every week over on phyllisschlafly.com. We make sure to archive and check it out there. We'll take a break and be right back. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Back in a moment. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Time to catch up with Todd Benzman, our friend Todd Benzman. He is the Senior National Security Fellow over at the Center for Immigration Studies. He has been writing and speaking about the border for 4 or 5 years, very, very articulately. And in the last probably 6 months has really, I think, hit critical mass in terms of people listening to what he was saying. His previous book, which was called Todd, it's not in front of me. Covert Border War. Is that it? Covert Border War?
America's Covert Border War. Yes.
There it is. Yeah. Which is so important in light of the images we saw this week of, of military aged men pushing across the border, overrunning law enforcement. I think it was the Texas Guard. And the question becomes, what's going on here? And, you know, I did an interview the other day, Todd, with an expert on China. We were talking about lots of other aspects of China, but it came around to the border. And he said, look, there's Chinese nationals coming through the border. They see it. They're not sending in, kind of entrepreneurs. They're sending in people that are on a mission. So welcome back, Todd Benzman. First of all, I know it's no great comfort to you to be vindicated so dramatically, but this week has certainly been a stark indication that it's a national security problem, as well as whatever else you think about it.
Yeah, that's right. And I wrote two pieces this week about people on the terrorist watch list who got caught crossing the border or after crossing the border in the interior. One of them was apparently an Eritrean who lived on the border with Yemen, or, you know, right across from the Red Sea from Yemen.
Right.
And was involved in a 4-hour armed, standoff with police in North Carolina. This guy, nobody really knows how he came in or what his track is. The lieutenant governor of North Carolina held a press conference and sent a letter to Biden demanding answers on how this guy ended up there on the terror watch list. And a lot of other questions. There are always lots of questions about these situations. And then the New York Post ran an analysis of mine about a Lebanese member of Hezbollah who crossed in at El Paso from Juarez, and just this month, and went straight to confession and said, listen, I'm going to just be straight with you. I am Hezbollah. I came here to build a bomb. I was going to go to New York and build it for Hezbollah. I've been a member for 7 years. I don't want to do it anymore. I just want to be in the United States. And maybe he was trying to trade on this. But he actually did flag on the watch list, according to reports. So there is some merit in what he's saying. He was already on the watch list. He was known. Those are just two recent cases. But, you know, we've had well over 300 on the terror watch list who cross in and get apprehended. And the reason this is happening is, as I've said many times on your show, is this is the most multinational mass migration crisis in history. 170 different countries are represented here. 45% of everybody reaching the southern border is not from Mexico or Central America. They're from all these other countries. And we're also bringing them in on these made-up admissions programs by flying them in and letting them cross over the land ports, cross through the land ports using the CBP-1 app. There was a hearing on that yesterday, but the vetting is very minimal. You can't vet people from places like Iran and Syria and Afghanistan. They're not sharing their databases with us, even if they had them. So that's really kind of the problem here. We're having a lot of these cases right now.
Yeah. We're talking with Todd Bensman again. CIS.org is the website for the Center for Immigration Studies. CIS.org. He's got a page there, and there's other great writings of that organization. Also, ToddBensman.com. You can see his, as he mentioned, a couple pieces this week and regular publications all across, from New York Post to others. And his books are there too. Todd, a few weeks ago when we talked to you, you described this kind of the facts that were coming out about sort of a secret negotiation between the American government and the Mexicans and the cartels, I guess, to slow things down so things didn't look so bad. And you it was very eye opening to me to hear you walk through what you had pieced together had happened in terms of high level American diplomats going to Mexico, working out this thing because they know it's politically impalatable. Well, it's politically impalatable again. Do they not care, or is the system breaking down, or what's going on here? Because I thought, oh boy, if they're smart enough to know they've got to sit tight for 6 months, maybe they get this issue off the top of the mind of the American people. It's not working. What do we have going on here?
Right. Well, as I reported about 2 months ago, Biden administration cut a deal with Mexico for Mexico to deploy 30,000 troops and INM and throw state police into the mix too, to round up immigrants on the northern border with us and force them into the southern provinces, keep them off the borders, shut down the freight trains, and put up roadblocks everywhere to just really reduce the 14,000 a day that we were seeing,
right,
to a less media interested number, like 5,000, 7,000 a day.
Right.
That is, I think I broke that story. Nobody's covered that. But then the other day I got a call from 60 Minutes and they're doing the story, and Fox News is doing the story. And now all of a sudden, New York Times, The Washington Post wrote a piece about this as though it was brand new. It's just funny to me because, I've been writing about that massive Mexican operation for 2 months all alone.
Right.
The numbers, not to pat myself on the back, I just want to get to the point here, which is that the numbers fell from 14,000 a day to 4,000 and 5,000 a day, and the media went away. But the numbers are coming back up. It looks like the Mexicans might be just kind of releasing opening an escape valve for the pressure to kind of release on them, and they're letting more through. We're up to 7,000 a day. We saw this mad rush in El Paso, breaking through the Texas fortifications, right through it, like a knife through butter, man. They just pounded right through there. You can expect to see more of that sort of thing, too. But I think that may have had more to do with the court case where the Supreme Court let Texas have this law to round up immigrants briefly, and then they took it away, and then now it's back, and then it was taken away. I think it may have had something to do with that.
So is your sense, I mean, Mexico is still trying to keep that deal, to try to keep it down, but I guess the reality is it's ticking up and it's just messy, right? I mean, you can't control people completely.
Right. And also, you know, Mexico has a tremendous amount of leverage right now over the Biden campaign and government. Those are two separate things. I think the Biden campaign is running policy now, not the government. But that said, Mexico, if they want something, can just open the spigot a little bit and get it right now through November, right? And they may be signaling something to the Biden administration by letting the trains run again. It's hard to really tell what's going on here. The numbers have never been reduced to, you know, less than stratospheric. It was just reduced from ionospheric to stratospheric.
Well, and one of the ways you said it was important is that if you drop the numbers down, the media goes away. They see something that looks sort of reasonable. It may be unreasonable in our experience, but compared to what they had going, what I don't know, Todd, and I give you a lot of credit for this, is it's kind of like it's the opposite of the boy that cried wolf. It's the boy that kept crying over and over until people started listening. You know, now I think there's enough details. You know, the national security threat, the military aged men pushing through on the Texas border. You know, the trafficking, the conversations now about trafficking. I heard a House staffer telling me had some data that they were trying to track down, that under the Trump administration, they were looking closely at they would check swab families to make sure they were related, and they were finding out that they weren't related. They'd save the kids, and the Biden administration stopped that. And so all kinds of things that are coming up. Finally, these details. I'm out of time, though, Todd. I'm sorry. Todd Benzman. It's toddbenzman.com. Go to his website. He's got his books, but also his writings. And I always encourage Center for Immigration Studies, CIS.org, a great organization for which he is their National Security Fellow. Thanks, Todd. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Take care.
We'll take a break, everybody. We'll be right back. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Back in a moment.
This is the Phyllis Schlafly Report, a daily commentary continuing the conservative pro-family legacy of Phyllis Schlafly. Now, here's the president of Phyllis Schlafly Eagles, Ed Martin.
In 1971, the tide of public opinion ran against abortion. Every single pro-abortion bill was shot down in state legislatures in 1971 and 72. However, the issue changed in 1973 with the Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions, which made first trimester abortion restrictions illegal in all 50 states. Far from settling the abortion issue for all time, it was the beginning of a long legal and political battle, as the late Phyllis Schlafly once said. In 1973, the Republican Party had yet to take a firm stance one way or another on abortion. The Republican platform question was still wide open. Phyllis Schlafly wanted to remedy this because a party platform enables the party to express the grassroots will of the constituency. Phyllis Schlafly set out in 1976 to bring this legal and political battle into Republican Party politics. She describes the 1976 Kansas City Republican National Convention as the first instance of the pro-family movement raising its voice in national politics. Thanks to Phyllis's service on the platform committee, it was also the first instance of the Republican platform acknowledging abortion. During the 1980 Reagan Revolution, Phyllis led the platform to affirm its support for unborn children. She and the platform committee also removed the pro-equal rights amendment plank. The ERA would have required constitutionally protected taxpayer funding for abortion. 1984 was the year that the pro-life plank was locked into the platform. The platform stated that, quote, the unborn child has a fundamental individual right to life which cannot be infringed. We therefore reaffirm our support for a human life amendment to the Constitution, and we endorse legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment's protections apply to unborn children, end quote. This was the strongest pro-life wording yet in any party platform, and especially the Republican platform. And Phyllis and pro-lifers across the country have defended this plank in every Republican convention since.
This has been the Phyllis Schlafly Report from Phyllis Schlafly Eagles. Our mission, clearly stated at phyllisschlafly.com, is to enable and mobilize grassroots activism on behalf of cherished conservative values. You're encouraged today to go online and read the goals we support and those we oppose. Then join us. That's phyllisschlafly.com. Thanks for listening, and come back next time for the Phyllis Schlafly Report.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Hey, wrapping things up. This is a what you need to do, a window today, what you need to do, because this is an important topic. And I don't really have as good an action item for this as I like. Sometimes you say, you know, call so-and-so, show up at such-and-such, you know, read this, you know, do that, vote this way. Sometimes it's more specific. This is a broader slightly, but I have to tell you, the persecution of Jeff Clark is such a black eye on this country. Jeff Clark has a bar complaint against him from the DC, the District of Columbia Bar Association. And they have an unwritten rule, the DC bar, because you can imagine the DC bar, there's a lot of lawyers that work in the government that the DC bar, you know, it would have the jurisdiction over in some sense. Many of them would be practicing law and be DC bar members. Then they become attorney general or associate attorney general, or they become the general counsel to the Department of Homeland Security, whatever it is. And if it were possible for any single person to file a complaint against a DC bar, you know, a lawyer in the DC bar, you'd have complaints all the time, right? If you're a Democrat and you hate the Republican administration, you'd file a bar complaint, all that. So the DC bar has had a rule, an unwritten rule. It's difficult to imagine how you'd make it codify it formally. But the unwritten rule is basically, if you don't have personal knowledge, firsthand knowledge of conduct, you can't file a bar complaint about it, right? So you can't be, you know, living in Missouri and you say, the attorney general just did something I don't like, I'm going to file a bar complaint against him and file it. Because generally when you file a bar complaint, you're allowed to file it without any, There's no cost. There's no penalty if it's deemed that it was not valid. So it's wide open for the citizens to say, hey, I live in Missouri, I'm in St. Louis, and I see this lawyer, he acted badly, I file a bar complaint against him, I want people to know. The bar would look into it, the Missouri bar. DC said, look, we're not going to have it so that every time somebody hates what the attorney general does or the general counsel somewhere, that there's bar complaints. So you have to have personal, firsthand knowledge of the conduct. Well, in the case of Jeff Clark, the complaints against him were that he was advising his client, the president of the United States, about what possible legal options he had, which is what lawyers do. In fact, lawyers come up with as many different scenarios as they can possibly imagine as a way to manage or understand risk. So when you're sitting with a client, you say, well, it could go like this. It could go like that. There could be these facts. There could be this, that. They could use this law. They could try that law. You could have this judge. You have to take a whole bunch of factors in place. You have to take them into account to manage risk and make decisions about it. So Jeff Clark, by the nature of his job, very senior in the Department of Justice, a guy who had served in the highest levels of the Bush administration, W. Bush, and had been practicing law, Harvard graduate. He'd been practicing law, well-respected. He's now advising President Trump, who's trying to figure out what happened with this election, where tens of millions of Americans felt like and still feel it didn't go the way it seemed to be headed. There were things that happened that did not seem to be normal in the way elections work, stopping in the middle of the night and all these things. And so as a good lawyer, you're giving all the different options. And some of the options were you could stop things this way, you could go forward that way, you could just take it the way it's going, all the different options. A good advocare, the root, Latin root, give voice, to give voice to. A good advocate is going to give voice to all the different theories, all the ideas, all the things that were going on. And suddenly, because there was this massive effort to make it so no one would ever question the election of 2020, You should be afraid. You'll be sued by Dominion or others if you're saying the wrong things. If you're, and you'll settle if you're Fox News because you're worried about it. And if you're a lawyer, you got left-wingers, Democrats, not even left-wingers, Democrats, who say we can't upset the status quo, which is that we're not going to allow questioning. We're not going to have auditable elections. So go after all these different lawyers, whether it's Dean Eastman or Jeff Clark or Rudy Giuliani or Sidney Powell or any of them. 60, they had a project called the Project 65. And here's the point. Jeff Clark has had an illustrious career, and the D.C. bar next week will start a bar trial against him for being a good lawyer and a smart lawyer and a lawyer who cares and a lawyer who represents his client, a lawyer who is an advocate. And the two things that I deeply, deeply regret is that the D.C. bar is doing this at all, but also that there's not more lawyers saying out loud, this isn't right. This shouldn't happen. You could disagree vehemently. You could even tell all your friends, you could never hire Jeff Clark. He recommended this. That's not a theory. But you cannot use the bar and the license as lawfare against individuals doing their jobs, doing what they're hired to do. There's no allegation of criminal conduct. The DC bar is not talking about criminal conduct. They're not allowed to. And the most despicable part about it, by the way, is in this case, the D.C. bar could not have a first person account because the people in the room were Donald Trump and Jeff Clark, maybe a few others. And instead, they accepted a letter from Senator Dick Durbin, Illinois Democrat, partisan, saying, oh, yeah, we got a problem. You got to look at this. And they used that as a complaint and they broke their norms. Their norms that said, we're not going to do these, you know, third party, I think something was really rotten, please do something about it. They said, oh, in this case, Senator Durbin's got a senior position in the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to let him make this objection. And we're going to use it as a basis to punish Jeff Clark. So the to-do is pray for Jeff Clark. He's a faithful guy. Find a way to track this story. I don't think Jeff has put out much request for a legal defense fund. But if he does, we'll make sure to put that out there because it's costing him a lot of money. And demand that people do the right thing and stop this madness. Anyway, that's all I've got. Jeff Clark, what a good guy. We got to go. Thank you, Ryan Height. I'm Mason Mohan. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Talk to you then.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.